From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! He's charged with blowing up a Cuban airliner, killing 76 people. He takes credit for the recent series of hotel bombings in Cuba and boasts close ties to U.S. intelligence agencies and financial support from Cuban-American leaders. His name is Luis Posada. We'll speak with the reporter to whom he's chosen to tell a portion of his life story. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Russian government and international leaders concluded an agreement. The agreement would provide $17.1 billion in additional loans over the next 2 years. Combined with existing international assistance, the new pact would bring total lending to Russia to $22.6 billion this year and next. In national news, the Reverend Al Sharpton and two former civil rights attorneys who championed the cause of Tawanette Brawley a decade ago, trumpeting the black teenager's tale of abduction and gang rape by white policemen, were ruled yesterday to have defamed a white prosecutor whom they accused of joining in the rape. After the trial that lasted almost 8 months, a jury of four whites and two blacks found in favor of Stephen Pagones. The Reverend Al Sharpton was found liable for 7 out of 11 statements, Alton Maddox found liable for 2 of 6, and C. Vernon Mason liable for 1 of 5. A black female juror, one of two black panelists, refused to sign the verdict sheet, this according to a courthouse source. And still, after all of these years, it is not clear exactly what has happened to Tawana Brawley. The United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan has criticized the United States and 9 other countries for taking uncompromising positions in 11th-hour negotiations. This at the same time to establish an international criminal court, according to a letter distributed yesterday. The conference for establishing the court to try perpetrators of war crimes ends in Rome Friday, but nations like the United States and India have been hardening their stands. The American delegate David Sheffer said again yesterday that the U.S. opposes giving the court jurisdiction over states that do not sign the founding treaty or their nationals. This means that if a state has not ratified the treaty, its citizens cannot be prosecuted. And Secretary General Kofi Annan denied yesterday that the UN was looking to mediate the conflict in Chiapas, the southern state of Mexico, even though he expressed concern over the state of peace in Mexico's southernmost state. Annan made it clear that although Mexican officials had sent him reports about Chiapas, which he will study, they had not formally sought UN help. It's widely considered highly unlikely that Mexico would make such a request. The government has moved to bar international observers from Chiapas. Commanders from the National Liberation Army, ELN, Colombia's second largest rebel force, met non-government leaders today for a second day of talks. The latest peace talks started on Sunday and were likely to finish Wednesday in time for a news conference scheduled. The ELN is calling for agrarian reform, a reduction in the role of foreign multinationals in Colombia's oil industry, greater social spending, and a halt to the dirty war tactics of the armed forces and right-wing death squad. This news from Miami more than 30 years after they were sentenced to death for the murder of two white gas station attendants. Two black men received $500,000 each from the state of Florida yesterday for wrongful conviction. Freddie Pitts and Wilbert Lee were twice convicted by all white juries of the gas station murders in 1963. Pitts and Lee were on death row for 9 years. The convictions were thrown out after a white man, Curtis Adams, admitted the murders. In a retrial, however, Adams' confession was ruled inadmissible. Pitts and Lee were convicted again. They were pardoned in 1975 by Florida Governor Reuben Askew, who cited substantial doubt about their guilt. For more than 20 years, both men asked the state to compensate them for the years they had spent behind bars. arguing that the North American Free Trade Agreement is actually a treaty. The Steelworkers Union and an allied group asked a federal judge yesterday to rule it unconstitutional because it was not approved by a two-thirds vote of the Senate. At the urging of the Clinton administration, NAFTA was approved as a trade agreement by majorities in both the Senate and House in 93. The Senate approved NAFTA by a vote of 61 to 38, enough for a trade agreement, but short of the two-thirds margin needed for a treaty. And this news from Texas, a company there called GNI Group Incorporated was awarded a $10 million contract to recycle the nation's supply of napalm. And Navy officials prepared yesterday to load the first shipment on a train bound for the company's Deer Park facility just east of Houston. 10,000 gallons of the jellied gasoline left over from the Vietnam War were taken by truck from the Fallbrook Naval Weapons Facility to nearby Camp Pendleton and put on a rail car. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A powerful Cuban-American exile group denied yesterday that it or its late chairperson had financed a Cuban exile operative linked to bombings and other violence against Cuba's President Fidel Castro. The Cuban-American National Foundation dismissed as lies a New York Times article that quoted the operative, Luis Posada Carriles, as saying he'd received money from the late CANF leader, Jorge Mascanosa, to finance his activities. The CANF was responding to a two-part series in the New York Times that ran on Sunday and Monday. The first piece of this explosive series on Sunday was headlined, Key Cuba Foe Claims Exile Backing. It went on to say, a Cuban exile who's waged a campaign of bombings and assassination attempts aimed at toppling Fidel Castro says that his efforts were supported financially for more than a decade by the Cuban-American leaders of one of America's most influential lobbying groups. The exile, Luis Posada Carriles, said he organized a wave of bombings in Cuba last year at hotels, restaurants, and discotheques, killing an Italian tourist and alarming the Cuban government. Mr. Posada was schooled in demolition and guerrilla warfare by the Central Intelligence Agency in the 1960s. Joining us now is the journalist who wrote that piece and who over the years has reported quite extensively on Cuba and other parts of the world, Anne Louise Bardic. She joins us now by telephone. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Anne.
Hi.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, these articles are quite something. You wrote them with Larry Roeder. First of all, tell us how you got in touch with Luis Posada.
Through several intermediaries, just sort of the usual procedure. I had read his book, Los Caminos del Guerrero, The Paths of the Warrior. Larry Roeder and I had written another story on May 5th about four men who had been captured in a boat off of Puerto Rico, and one of them was from Union City, and I had been interviewing him. His name is Angel Alfonso, and he asked me if I had read this book, and I hadn't, and he talked about the book and Luis Posada, and that got me kind of interested, so I got the book, and Larry and I each got copies and read it, and kind of, stunned by some of the things we read in it, and then just made a few inquiries the way one normally does, and I use some people who are kind of Venezuelan-based, and one of them knew him quite well, and sure enough, he returned this man's phone call and wanted to do the interview. Said he wants to see you. So,
Larry and
I went down to the Caribbean.
And you don't want to say where you actually saw him.
No.
Why do you think he agreed to speak to you? He is not known for speaking to journalists.
I must tell you, I don't have a clue. I know that the Miami Herald and some terrific reporters there had been trying for a very long time to get an interview with him and hadn't succeeded. I have written a bit about this area, but and so has Larry Roeder. So I don't know if it was happenstance or circumstance or whatever it was. I think it was a combination of several things. I think with the death of Jorge Mascanosa, there's a big void and big vacuum in this region of the exile community. And there was also some scuttlebutt in Miami that he was a little sore with that particular group. There had been some financial arrangements that had ceased, and I don't know. I'm sure it was a confluence of several elements. It's never usually one thing.
Anne Louise Bardek is our guest, and we're going to spend the hour with her because based on these two articles, a lot of activists around the issue of Cuba who've been focusing on it since the revolution of 1959 have for a long time believed, many felt that they had evidence of the nature of the opposition to Fidel Castro, particularly in this country, certain aspects of that opposition, particularly talking about the Cuban American National Foundation of Miami. Now, I do want to say at the beginning of this interview that we call them, we ask them to join us today, as well as calling the State Department because of allegations Luis Posada made about years of working with the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI, and both said that they would not come on with us. So we are continuing this interview with Anne Louise Bardek so we can just look at this one man's life as he has told it to you, and I should ask, why do you believe him?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think you have to decide, he has given inconsistent answers over his lifetime and at different times. Yesterday, the foundation had a press conference in Miami, and evidently in the middle of the press conference, a reporter ran through. I wasn't there, but based on what people told me, a reporter from Univision ran through saying they had a videotape of him recanting, and there were like three questions. It was a very peculiar interview that was supposedly not done with the foundation, but the tape was delivered there right away, in which he said, no, he didn't say this, and no, he didn't say that, and no, he didn't say that. So I gathered they kind of rustled him up to make some quick denials. So it was just three or four questions, but basically he did say he didn't. I think he said something about Jorge Mascanosa did not pay for these various.
Well, we'll talk about some of the things he said in the Univision piece after people understand what it is that he told you. Why don't you give us a sketch of Luis Posada's life? And I should also add, in these extensive pieces that you did on Sunday and Monday in the New York Times, based on the interviews with Luis Posada, you also interviewed a number of other people and had national security documents as well. So it's not just based on the conversation with him. But tell us how Luis Posada Carriles got his start.
Well, he was born in Cienfuegos in Cuba. That's sort of the south-central area near Trinidad, from a kind of upper-middle-class family. He went to the University of Havana. He was in college, in fact, with Fidel Castro, who was a few years older than him. He has some interesting recollections about Castro. He said he wasn't at all political until the revolution. And at that point, there's something quite interesting in his family. He was the only member of his family to leave. The rest of the family were pretty ardent Fidelistas, his parents, his two brothers, and a sister. One of the funniest CIA documents we got, with a file that the National Security Archives helped arrange for us, was that I think the CIA, somebody asked him to try to recruit his brother, Ricardo, and I guess there was a lame attempt that backfired. He was really one of the first people out of Cuba into the, what do you want to call it, among the counter-revolutionary group. I think he was among the early CIA recruits. I think that's fairly evident. He went to Fort Benning, Georgia, and was trained for Bay of Pigs. And he speaks about how every day for 7 years he stood side by side next to Jorge Mascinosa. Also with him there was Felix Rodriguez, who would emerge later as the key person in the Iran-Contra. And in fact, Fort Benning is a very interesting breeding ground. So basically,
Felix Rodriguez was not only a key person in Iran-Contra scandal, but also was one of the last soldiers, right, to see Che Guevara alive.
Right. He was among the last to interrogate Che Guevara before he was executed by the Bolivian police.
And stood with President Clinton as he signed the Helms-Burton Act.
Yes. Well, they all have. Not Luis Posada, who's been a fugitive, but the other two, certainly. He went, after the debacle of the Bay of Pigs, he just basically has devoted his whole life to, he's sort of been basically the military wing of the whole Cuban, the really militant Cuban exile movement. And I think it's very important that people understand, people talk about Cuban exiles like it's this huge monolithic element. There's many groups in the Cuban exile movement. There's left, right, middle, up, down, whatever. To say that, that they're just not a monolith. And so he, among the, you could say, the militant right, Luis Posada has had sort of a heroic stature for all these assassination attempts, all these bombings, etc. His fortunes really plummeted when, in 1976, he was arrested with Orlando Bosch and two Venezuelans for blowing up the Cubana airline that killed 73 people, mostly civilians, including the national fencing team of Cuba, most of them teenagers. It was tied to him because at that point he was running a security agency in Venezuela, and two of the men who worked for him were captured in Barbados right after they had allegedly planted the bomb, and evidently they confessed and they said they worked for Posada. He denies his involvement, but the CIA files and extensive interviews indicate otherwise.
Now, you talk about how before the bombing of the Cuban Airlines in 1976, he was in Venezuela working with a security firm. But in your timeline in the New York Times, right, 1967, you say he moves to Venezuela and with CIA help takes a job as chief of operations of the country's security police.
Yeah, that's an interesting development. I think what happened is there's some, after Bay of Pigs, they all gave up that the U.S. Army would, or U.S. government would do an overt strike and just land in Cuba. They would not, weren't going to repeat Bay of Pigs. So what they did is a lot of operations, the most famous, I think, being, Mongoose. And Mascinosa was a founding member of a group called RESE, which was Cuban Representation in Exile. And they funded a lot of these paramilitary things, and we found the CIA files on that, as well as Mascinosa himself did testify before Congress to that effect. Posada got this incredible job running, being chief of operations at DCIP, which is Venezuelan intelligence. He really started being there from like 64 on, and by 67 he was their chief. And really he was hired for his anti-communist ire, and one of his big things was purging the country of guerrillas, left-wing guerrillas, who he believed were Castro-financed, may very well have been. And he also spread out through the region. So he got an incredible reputation as a guerrilla fighter. As he says in the story, all communists are the same. All are bad. All are evil. And he certainly won himself a huge amount of enemies. And one of the great ironies of his life, as he pointed out, is that Douglas Brava, one of the guerrilla leaders, and another one, I think his name is Teodoro Petkov. Anyway, two of the big guerrilla leaders of that period are both in power now in Venezuela. So his fortunes have have changed dramatically. And then later, of course, he worked on Iran-Contra and fought against the Salvador guerrillas.
Well, we'll talk about some of what he did later on, which is also very significant, and talk about the Guatemala aspect of the story, as well as his links to both U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA and the FBI, and to Jorge Mascanosa, which is what the Cuban American National Foundation held its news conference about yesterday, decrying the your allegations, and also, I think it's fair to say roughing up your fellow reporter there, Larry Roeder. It was quite a raucous scene at the Miami news conference yesterday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Our guest is Ann Louise Bardic, and she has co-written a two-part series in the New York Times on the life of Luis Posada Carriles, who is what some might call the U.S. government's favorite Cuban terrorist. Stay with us.
Llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarín. De Alto Cedro voy para Macané. Llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarín. De Alto Cedro voy para Macané. Llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarín.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we go through this two-part series in the New York Times on a key Cuba foe, who claims that he has exiles backing in terrorist activities over a 40-year period going back to the Cuban Revolution. His name is Luis Posada Carriles. Well, that's one of his names, because he actually goes on four passports, one of them being American. And his life is partially laid out in these pages as a result of a conversation, extremely rare conversation, he has refused to speak to journalists for many years, that he had with two New York Times reporters, Larry Roeder and Ann Louise Bardic. And we are joined by Ann Louise Bardic on the phone with us now. Also, in terms of background on Ann, she was one of the few journalists to get an extensive interview with Fidel Castro, which ran in Vanity Fair, where she is a contributing editor, in 1994. Again, Ann Louise Bardic, our guest for this hour. You talked about Operation Mongoose. Alexander Haig, the former chief of staff, spoke on Nightline in December talking about Operation Mongoose. It didn't get a lot of headlines, but if we were talking about any other country, it may well have. As he said, Operation Mongoose, in Operation Mongoose, we blew up bridges, people died, they ran mothership operations through the Central Intelligence Agency. What was Luis Posada's role in Operation Mongoose, this wave of terror against the state of Cuba?
Well, he actually denies being involved with Mongoose, and he said he was pretty much a rogue person who got CIA help, as opposed to being part of it, that he devised his own particular operations. He admits to the attempt on the one in Chile when Allende was president in 71, the assassination attempt on Castro then, which was a very close call, by the way. That was about as close as it got for Castro. I think what they had were Venezuelan photographers there, and who had gotten press clearances, and one of them was supposed to kill him. And I think it was only a lack of nerve that prevented that. And then, and as recently as 95 in Cartagena at the Colombian summit, he had another one similar to, I think, using photographers. And then, of course, last year you had the wave of bombings. It's been, but he's pretty much been a freelancer, I guess, is the way, where he runs his own operations and where he's in charge, not so much that he's a player among others. I think he became quite disillusioned after Bay of Pigs when he's not in control.
Let's talk about his relationship with U.S. intelligence, and then we'll go to Jorge Mascanosa, that has been so explosive for the Cuban American National Foundation, saying he received more than $200,000 from the Cuban American leader, who has had close ties to many American presidents, coming right up through President Clinton, giving enormous campaign contributions. But first to U.S. intelligence and that relationship. You talked about his relationship with the CIA with him in Venezuela. He broke out of jail after the Cubana Airlines blowing up
10 years
Cubana.
Later.
And when he broke out of jail, do you believe that the CIA had a role in that breakout?
I actually don't. I think that by 76, especially based on the files, the classified files, they had pretty much, the CIA, it seems to me, were pretty sour on him in the 70s because of Cubana. I think that the CIA believed that he was responsible for the CIA downing, and didn't believe his denials, and that was just a pretty big pill for them to swallow, even though that was their business at that time.
It is significant that he denies blowing up the plane but does own up to doing other things.
Yes, it is. I don't know, but there have been other case times with other reporters or where he has kind of indicated he did do it. I looked into it pretty extensively, and I think we quote a CIA analyst who was working on that case at that time, and he said there were no other suspects. Certainly,
well, Orlando Bosch.
What?
Orlando Bosch.
Bosch was, Posada and Bosch. Mm-hmm. The funny thing is that Bosch has always been quite proud of it. And he, in fact, he is said to have given an interview shortly after he was arrested in Venezuela, I think with an American, young American reporter, and actually said that he did it. And people in Miami have reported having private conversations with him, in which he has said that as well. I was looking at an interview he did with a Miami reporter, and, you know, he called it a legitimate action of war and defended it and very much demonized the people who were aboard the plane and called it the young fencing team, you know, agents of Castro, et cetera, who, you know, because, anyway, that basically, you know, deserved to die or, you know. He went on at great length. I asked Posada about that, and he said Bosch is always saying he did it. He knows it. And he said, but he didn't. the truth is very, very elusive in this world. This is a very dark, shadowy world. But the concurrence of opinion I've had from everybody I've spoken to over the period is that they did get the right people. Although Venezuelan justice is a very peculiar, mercurial thing, Bosch eventually won some acquittals. I don't think Posada did, but the other two were. Their other two friends actually confessed, I think, at one point. But, you know, in Venezuela, you are guilty until proven innocent, which is the case in most Latin American, in many Latin American countries. And most Americans are not aware of this. So you can stay in jail for many, many years and without ever being proven. And that's one of the problems why they have such rioting in Venezuelan jails. Anyway, so I'm just saying is there never was a final definitive verdict, mostly owing to the peculiarities of Venezuelan justice.
And Luis Bardach, what about his relationship? What about Luis Posada Quilides' relationship with the U.S. intelligence agencies, with the FBI and the Central Intelligence Agency?
What he said was, I had shown him his Iran-Contra report, which was done by two FBI agents, and one name was blacked out. And he pointed to it, and he said, oh, Jorge did this. And he was referring to an FBI agent named Jorge Kaczynski, or George Kaczynski, out of the Miami influence, Miami office. And he then said, do you know Jorge? Very eagerly. And he said, he's a great guy and an old friend. And I was quite taken back by that, because he clearly evinced that, you know, it was so spontaneous. It was clear it was a relationship. And I just thought that was quite odd that, you know, somebody who's a fugitive from justice, because he has been a fugitive ever since he escaped from prison, would have such a kind of cozy, you know, or these, you know, listen, I only, you know, this was his point of view. God knows what the other, his friends thought. But he spoke with them with so much affection. And I thought that was a little odd. The FBI, you know, really for weeks and weeks refused to comment. And finally, the night before we were going to run the story, they came out and said that they didn't have a, you know, they only met twice. But then Posada said, he said, you know, Jorge's going to retire this year. Now, that's, you know, that's sort of a personal, that's something you wouldn't know if you hadn't had contact in 10 years, you know, what somebody's retirement plans are. So there's definitely a gray area, and it suggests a lot. But, you know, we don't know. We don't know what Agent Kaczynski's, what he was doing, what he maybe, if he was working with informers or confidants. I think at one point they said that, I'm not sure, they make a big difference between informers and confidants. Now, Luis Posada has a history of being an informer. And in fact, when he got on very dicey ground with the CIA, one of the things that just stunned all of us was that we saw that he, according to the CIA files, when they were getting ready to cut him loose, he actually informed on his good pal Orlando Bosch and said that Bosch was going to try to kill Salvador Allende's nephew. I mean, that's quite a stunner. So I guess the moral of the story is there's no honor among this group here. I mean, although you must understand that this man is usually charming, entertaining. He's a kind of well-known Casanova, a great marksman. He's sort of very James Bond-like.
You talk about his involvement with Iran-Contra. On October 7, 1986, a Contra resupply plane is shot down and the operation is exposed. It's quickly disclosed that the Cuban carrying the passport, Ramon Medina, is actually Posada. What role did Ramon Medina play?
Well, what happened, now this is an interesting thing where it has certainly raised the specter of did the CIA or the FBI, you know, what did they know? He escapes from prison, and in a matter of weeks, he's in Salvador working for Felix Rodriguez, and if I recall correctly, he says that Felix gives him a new identity and a passport saying Ramon Medina. Now, Felix at this point is working for the United States government running the Contra resupply in direct violation of the law. And suddenly, you know, we have Luis Posada going from prison and being a fugitive to basically running the Contra resupply. And that was his new identity because he was a fugitive and he was wanted. And for many years, he lived as Ramon Medina. In fact, when Cruz León, the young Salvadoran, was captured for the bombings in Havana last year, I think that's what he said. He said, I work for Ramon Medina. And his mother told the Mexican police, or at least it was in a Mexican article, she said, oh, no, my son could never be involved in such a thing. He works for a very respectable company, private security company in Salvador. He works for a man named Ramon Medina.
Now, Luis Posada has four passports, he tells you.
Oh, at least.
One of them is a U.S. passport.
Right.
You also talk about whether he comes in and out of the United States, this man who takes pride in a series of bombings just in the last year in Cuba, mm-hmm. which would certainly, by most people's standards, put him on a terrorist list that you think he would be picked up by the U.S. government. Does he come into the United States, and who issued him his passport?
Well, I think there's no question about that, because for one thing, he told me that he met Angel Alfonso, who is the man of the four of the Aguadilla boating incident. He met Angel, who he calls La Cota, he said, in Miami in 91. Well, and then later he changes it. He said, oh, no, it had to be 81. Well, 81 he was in prison, so he couldn't. He didn't get out of prison until 85. Listen, the stories vary, and people should understand that he has told different things at different times. What we're publishing in the New York Times on Sunday and Monday is what he told us. But, you know, one can find inconsistencies at different statements he said throughout his life, although most of what he told us are not moke, but a large portion of it you can actually find in his book. In fact, particularly that's what led us along the lines of the foundation of Moscanosa, because it actually says in the book that he gets visits from Alberto Hernandez, who's the current chairman of the Cuban American National Foundation. Another point, he says, I sent for Gaspar Jimenez from Miami, and Gaspar works for to discuss his escape, and Gaspar Jimenez works for Dr. Hernandez. I mean, you can find Feliciano Foyo, the treasurer. All these names are mentioned repeatedly through the book, Moscanosa, and about these relationships.
Well, let's talk about these relationships. Yesterday, again, a news conference in Miami, the powerful Cuban-American exile group stood up for themselves and for their late chair, Jorge Moscanosa. It was a raucous news conference. They shouted at your co-writer on these two pieces, Larry Roeder, and called him a liar. Moscanosa's son was there, Jorge Masantos, and he said there's absolutely no truth to any of the allegations that were made in that story. Masantos said his father knew Posada decades ago, but did not sustain any relationship with Luis Posada, did not fund any of his activities, and had no contact nor supported what Luis Posada stands for and represents. Explain what it is that Luis Posada said about his relationship with Jorge Moscanosa and the Cuban American National Foundation.
Well, he said without reservation that he was close friends and, you know, good relations with many of the leaders. He never had said that he's, you know, on the foundation or on the board or director or anything like that. He never talked about an official capacity, but what a warm, affectionate relationship he had with Jorge Moscanosa, how long he had known him. He told an interesting story about knowing the man, a man named Torres, who had first hired Jorge Moscanosa, and we just didn't have the space to run it, but about how Torres had hired him, and Torres had a company called Torres Iglesias, and I think they had met through Rese, and how he once met with them, and they were getting along so beautifully, and a year later, Torres came to him and was in tears and said, I loved Jorge like a son. Now he's stolen everything. And, you know, of course, Moscanosa ended up getting the Church and Tower Company. I believe he paid $50,000 for it. And Posada told the story about how Torres told him how badly betrayed he felt by Jorge Mas. And, of course, Moscanosa then translated the name of that company to Church and Towers, which is what Torres y Iglesias means in Spanish, and that became the cornerstone of his multimillion-dollar empire. He talked about Alberto Hernandez. He talked about Pepe Hernandez, who's the president, and the first one being the chairman, and about Feliciano Foyo and how they go back all the way to Guatemala. And about how when he needed money, you know, Jorge would give him money. And that's how the way he put it, he said Jorge was in charge of everything. He controlled everything, big, little, small. Sometimes he said 5,000, 10,000, 20,000. Although he said Jorge didn't never want to know the details of what he did with the money. So it's a kind of vague area. And we very carefully worded the story, as you can see, that he got money from leaders of the foundation. We don't say he got money from the foundation, because it wasn't at all clear where the money you know, if it was personal, and we said that very explicitly in the story, whether it was personal funds, business funds, or whatever. He just said he received cash payments, and various people would deliver that. He identified one of these people, and like that.
And well, this is very significant because Jorge Mascanosa has always been very careful when it comes to the Cuban American National Foundation to separate the Cuban American National Foundation from violent activities, saying they support nonviolent change in Cuba, although they did not condemn the series of bombings that Luis Posada has taken credit for that took place in Cuba last year. But it's very significant if, in fact, Jorge Mascanosa, if what Luis Posada is saying is true, that Mascanosa gave him money. Mascanosa, well known for giving U.S. president after U.S. president campaign so-called contributions. We're talking to Anne Louise Bardach, and she is the co-author of two pieces in the New York Times on Sunday and Monday, two very large page pieces. I mean, each piece is a couple of pages in the New York Times, based on 2 days of conversations in a walled Caribbean compound with Luis Posada Carriles. This is a man who is known by many in this country as one of the leading Cuban terrorists. He himself boasts about the string of bombings he has been involved with, talking about it being, part of what he believes in. That's bringing down Fidel Castro, something that he has yet to do. We're going to come back to our conversation with Anne Louise Bardach in just a minute. And by the way, folks, if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Anne Louise Bardach, who is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine, did one of the rare extensive interviews with Fidel Castro in 1994, and has a two-part series in the New York Times of Sunday and Monday of this week on a man, Luis Posada Carriles, one of his names, who is responsible for, well, by his own account, a series, or I would say a terror campaign against Fidel Castro's Cuba. And Luis Bardach, would you say that's a fair description of what Luis Posada boasts about?
The bombing campaign of last summer of 97?
Yes, among
many
issues
other things.
He has been in.
He talked about current operations, and he talked about something. He said in the next month or two there'll be very exciting news, and he made a cryptic remark about the answer lies in Africa. That there'll be help from Africa on the way. And
can you describe what Luis Posada looks like today?
Well, he was once a very handsome, derring-do guy, but he's now, he's 70, for one thing. He used to have a very strong chin, but in 1990, he was a near-death assassination attempt, and I think 12 bullets went through him, and some through the jaw that nearly severed his tongue. So his jaw and chin had to be completely reconstructed, and so he lost an inch on his chin. And he speaks with It's kind of a crushed, gravelly sound, almost. I mean, somebody described it to us like a deaf mute. And, he's kind of, for his age and everything, somewhat dapper and what he's been through.
The reason I ask for that description, having survived that assassination attempt, is he is a figure that is easily identifiable.
I would think so. I saw him on Univision last night, you know, wearing a big beard, which looked kind of ridiculous, and didn't do much to really, you know, disguise him. You could see from the top. I thought he took a pretty big risk because, of course, from the mouth up, you could, you know, see pretty much who he was. He still has a lot of hair, but he's showing his age in certain places.
He's 70 years old now.
What?
70 years old.
He turned 70 in February. Somebody said we should call this a piece, you know, jokingly, you know, grumpy old terrorists, you know.
Did he say more about what these plans are in the next month, where he says Africa will be a part of it?
He just said that, you know, he makes these cryptic remarks and that he's in touch with various operatives. He says that he has sources inside Cuba and sources outside. And the sad thing is, many people are very desperate for change in Cuba. So he does have support in, you know, various segments of the exile community. Mostly he's an icon in the far-right militant group. But for people who have kind of despaired about there being change or when will there ever be elections or whatever, he has some appeal to even that kind of middle-right people who just want to see any change occur down there.
You know, it's interesting that the Cuban American National Foundation was so adamant in their news conference that there's never been any support for Luis Posada in terms of financial support. The piece you did in the Times of May, A Plot on Castro, spotlights a powerful group of exiles, talks about a case we hear almost nothing about. But again, if it was against another country, we would hear a great deal about it. A group of men caught off a boat, a cabin cruiser called La Esperanza, near Puerto Rico. They are found with a cache of weapons. When they're caught, one of the men, Angel Alfonso Aleman, is quoted as saying to the U.S. customs investigator who searched the ship, "These weapons are mine. The others knew nothing about them. I placed them there myself. They are weapons for the purpose of assassinating Fidel Castro." Right. And when you trace these weapons back, they go to officials, leaders in the Cuban American National Foundation. Now,
that's
the
right.
Lawyer you
the
quote,
president, the Pepe Hernandez, is the president of CAMF. He owned the one rifle registered to him, and the other one is a man named Johnny Poe, who's actually a good friend of Posada's and very close also with Hernandez and a member of the brigade, et cetera.
And the man who said that they had these on board and they were heading to kill Castro, his lawyer warned in an interview that should the Justice Department try his client, he said, "We will go after the government very strongly and attack their hypocrisy," brandishing a sheaf of declassified CIA documents about government efforts to overthrow the Cuban leader. He complained for 30 years they tried to kill Castro. Now they say others can't do the very same thing they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
What about this group who was found off the coast of Puerto Rico, headed to kill Fidel Castro, they said, with this very close ties to the Cuban American National Foundation? In fact, the boat itself, the cabin cruiser, whose name was it registered in?
I think it's Yama, Antonio Yama, who's also on the executive. He's one of the executive directors. He's in the inner circle of the foundation as well, one of the executive directors, if I recall correctly at this moment. We're all waiting to hear about the superseding, what's called the superseding indictment, which is going to come out of Washington. We believe that the prosecutor and with the help of the FBI's research, you know, investigators, we believe that the prosecutor has urged their higher ups in Washington, out of the Violent Crimes and Terrorism Division, to file indictments about the other parties. We heard from the lawyers for Pepe Hernandez, who's the president of the foundation, that he did receive a target letter, as did, I guess, the man who owned the boat, if I recall correctly at this moment. But we've been waiting for weeks and weeks and weeks. And the decision, I guess, is going to be Janet Reno's whether to go forward.
Now, talk about the Cuban-American National Foundation's role in U.S. politics, because that's really what makes this all so significant.
Well, they have been the most decisive voice in policy. Jorge Mascanosa just about wrote the whole American policy. I mean, you know, to be somewhat facetious, but he was definitely a big part of the our policy from Reagan onwards. In fact, it was Reagan who set him up with Radio Martí and then Television Martí, and really almost to the exclusion of other voices. That's been the complaint in the exile community, is that the foundation, which is certainly welcome to their opinion, is the prevailing belief, has excluded other opinions from being expressed and have dominated the debate. Jorge Mas and his group wanted isolation, sanctions, embargoes, all that, and believe that is the only way to change Cuba. And obviously there's other points of view, but rarely have we seen them expressed within our own foreign policy.
You say that Janet Reno has to make a decision about this latest group of alleged terrorists.
It'll be the Justice Department, yes.
That's right, who said that they were aiming to kill Castro when he was going to meet with other Latin American leaders on Margarita Island off of Venezuela. Janet Reno, the attorney general who hails from Miami.
That's correct. Well, yes, I mean, everybody, that's quite an interesting thing. I mean, she was never particularly known as being very zealous when she was in Miami. There's a wonderful comment in our story, I think, by Robert Blakely, which surprised us all. I'm paraphrasing now, but he said, you know, I went through all these FBI files and I saw all this stuff, and I thought, you know, my God, why hasn't anybody done anything about this? I mean, the files are, you know, just lurid in detail, lurid about the allegations and charges. I mean, you see, there's one point, a plot to kill Henry Kissinger, and there's plots to kill so many, you know, well-known people, and of course, lesser-known people as well, that are continuously discussed in the CIA and FBI documents. So it is quite surprising that there's been so little. I guess that's an expression of the ambivalence of the policy. That's certainly been the complaint. And in fact, when we called the FBI in New Jersey, of course, we assumed that they had a copy of the letter about the what we were writing about and the facts that Posada had sent with the various people in New Jersey who were sending him money.
This was Union City, New Jersey.
Yeah, that's alleged.
Right-wing Cuban exiles.
That faxed letter, we just assumed and called the FBI, and I think the spokeswoman said, I got to tell you, quite frankly, this is the first we're hearing about this. There's no investigation going on. Now, this is a year after that letter surfaced and was made available to the FBI in Miami. So you would think that it would have at least floated up to New Jersey to where the various parties live.
Interesting, but also that one of the major proponents of the right-wing Cuban exile community, one who responds most completely to them, is the senator from New Jersey, Robert Torricelli, who is the father of this so-called Cuba Democracy Act that increased the stranglehold of the embargo against Cuba.
Well, Jorge Mascanosa and the foundation were hugely persuasive on both Republicans and Democrats in Congress because they gave tremendous campaign contributions, as the article discusses, and that can be evidently a persuasive element.
And Louise Bardek, we only have a few minutes, but one of the most compelling parts of this two article series that you did in the New York Times, based on your conversation with Luis Posada, was the Guatemala connection. And this ties right into the recent spate of bombings in Cuba against the restaurant and hotel industry that Luis Posada takes credit for. I was in Cuba in December. I was at the Copacabana, which is one of the hotels that was bombed, where the only fatality occurred, and that was of an Italian tourist. His father still sat there in the corner at the hotel and said he would not leave and wanted to show his support for Cuba. Luis Posada, what did he exactly say? How was this carried out? And what is the connection to Guatemala in his last few minutes?
Well, what he said was that that he had taken great pride in planning them so there wouldn't be fatalities, that they wanted just to create a big scandal, as he said, and a big publicity so people would stop being tourists in Cuba and stop investing, and that he thought, you know, he said, you know, a piece of shrapnel tore off from the bomb and flew 60 yards away. He said that tourist was 60 yards away, and then he started laughing. He said, if that piece of shrapnel had hit him any other place in the body, he would have been fine, but it went right to his jugular, and that was it. And then he said, you know, what can I say? He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But, you know, he thought, you know, one death, you know, were low casualties, and that was something to be quite, you know, he was proud of that. This is a lifetime soldier. You know, I asked him if he felt bad about the fact that Cruz León will probably spend his entire life in prison.
The man who was caught in Cuba.
Yes, and he said, no, he did it for the money. He was a mercenary.
But the man behind it, Luis Posada, was more certainly
And he spoke the same way about the Guatemalans. He says he doesn't trust the Guatemalans. He said they have no ideology. They're brutal thugs and that they just kill.
This is where he got the apparatus for the bombs.
Yes, he hires them. He says, you know, his bomb makers were out of the Guatemalan, you know, formerly in the Guatemalan Corps of Engineers. He said that the army, knew the Guatemalan army had killed the archbishop, and I said, are you sure? And he said, absolutely, of course they did.
In the case of Cruz León, though, he said he was only one of the his whatever soldiers who had gone into Cuba to set off the bombs. That there are others.
I don't know how much of that is true. Like I am not attesting to Luis Posada's veracity, because we do know he tells different stories at different times to different people. But he may want us to think there's more, or he may want us to think there's less. He said he was very, very gratified that he wanted the Cuban government to believe, you know, to sow suspicion and paranoia within the Cuban army that he had people within the high level of the military.
Does he have any fear, Luis Posada, that he would be arrested in the United States?
You know, it's a very fuzzy area. He said, you know, obviously he's a fugitive in Venezuela because he escaped from prison. So I said, well, I guess that puts you on the Interpol list. And he started laughing and he said, well, you know, they didn't pay their dues. So didn't pay their dues, so, I'm not on their list. And the way he rationalized it, he says, I'm not a U.S. citizen, so they have no power over me, and I don't do my crimes in the United States. I do them outside, and I only do stuff against Cuba. I'm not doing other countries. So that's not really true, but he admits to Cartagena, and he admits to Chile, and all kinds of other things. But he's saying he stays away from U.S. targets. He said that U.S. authorities could make life very unpleasant for him, that they could turn to Salvador and say, turn him over. But they've never have. He said his big worry today, and it's in the story, he says they think that the money for my operations comes from the United States. So we asked, we said, well, doesn't it? I mean, you pretty much have said that. He said, yes. And then he said, yes, it's obvious.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Ann Louise Bardak, co-author of two pieces in the Times of Sunday and Monday on the Cuban exile, Luis Posada Carriles, and what he has done over the years from 1959 through until today. Boasts responsibility in the last case of a series of bombings that blew up in hotels and restaurants in Cuba and killed one. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hsu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Y un día le brindé.